With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Clash. On Monday's episode, we went hell for leather in The Road Warrior, and today we're revving up for a wild ride as we take a look at this week's challenger from 2015. It's Mad Max Fury Road.
As the world fell, each of us in our own way was broken. It was hard to know who was more crazy. Me. Or everyone else.
We'll have a winner at the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clashbotters. Oh, what a day. What a lovely day. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Dilly.
January has been wonderful. Clashbotters have united in suggesting movies for us to cover. This is our final pairing, Fury Road versus The Road Warrior. Little reminder, if you haven't subscribed to us already, please do so. I know I say at the top of every second show every week, but I'm going to just carry on doing it until everyone has subscribed to us. Everyone. And if you can, give us a little rating. And if it lets you, on whatever platform you get your podcast, a review. It's very helpful. Remind us, Chris, who gave us this incredible pairing?
I'll just quickly say thank you to everyone who's written in and sent in suggestions for January. There were so many that we want to do and we will do in the future. But also, you know, we got lots of lovely messages as well, people saying how much they love the podcast and also saying how it's really helped them get through these many lockdowns we've had, which has been really nice. And the podcast has helped us get through lockdown, as have your lovely tweets and emails. So thank you all for that. But this one came from Greg E, who suggested Fury Road because it's one of his favourite films, and The Road Warrior because we liked that pairing a lot.
Good, good. Yes, just to echo Chris's sentiment, thank you. I read some of the emails myself, and they are very nice and hugely appreciated. And thank you for listening. Chris, you took us on a leisurely drive on Monday with The Road Warrior, which means that Victoria is taking us for a spin today with Fury Road V. Take us on a journey.
Their world is once again a bloody awful place. Enter Max, a scarred survivor who's used as a juice carton of blood for a war boy called Nux in a citadel ruled by the really awful Immortan Joe. Then we meet our real hero, Imperator Furiosa, played by Charlize Theron, who's stealing Joe's wives via an armoured war rig in an attempt to find the clan she was kidnapped from as a child in the Green Place, the ever so subtly named Vuvalini. When it turns out that Paradise is now also a blasted wasteland, Furiosa and the gals turn this ship around to kill Joe and take the undefended citadel as their own. No storming is required. Max doesn't even stay, even though he'd be bob on for a shag. The end.
Whoa, you made it sound like there was more plot than I actually remember in that film.
I know. I've tried quite hard because, and I don't mind that there isn't, but you could just like, they leave and then they go back and that's it.
Yeah. It's a weird one, isn't it? It's weird that it's, I mean, it works. It does yes. work. But the fact that they literally drive and then turn around and drive back and that is the movie is yeah. so strange.
It is strange. And there's even a conversation where someone says we should go this way. And Max is like, no, we just literally go back the way we came.
Oh. Doesn't Furious Attention go, but won't our viewers get bored sort of retreading yeah. the same steps? And he's like, no. There's going to be some guys on poles, which will entertain.
Yeah. Now, I've seen this film before, but I only watched it. I'm a bit, you know, embarrassing to admit it, after it was nominated for a shitload of Oscars, because then that got my attention because I wanted to see what all the fuss was about. And now, maybe if it hadn't been nominated for a shitload of Oscars, I wouldn't necessarily have sought it out, but I did. And I will say, watching it a second time, I enjoyed it more. Because I understood whose story it was going to be. And obviously, it's called Mad Max Fury Road. So first time around, I was waiting for Max to be like, and now this is my story. And once this time around, because I knew that wasn't going to quite happen, I could relax into it a little bit more and I enjoyed it. But what about you?
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I remember in the review I wrote for it after my first watch, I did say it could have been called Furious Furiosa. I took a nap after that.
But yeah, like that. That's so rubbish.
I was phoning it.
And George Miller's reading it. George Miller's reading it. Yeah, that's what I meant. That's why I called her Furiosa. Literally what I meant.
You've just said her name twice. That doesn't work. No, I was Furious Furiosa. Brilliant. It was towards the end of my tenure at that particular publication. So, you know, I really wasn't trying. Now, I was literally obsessed with the trailer for this film, like before it came out. It's probably the trailer I've watched most. It's had about 15 million views on YouTube. I think I'm a million of those. It's the one set to Verdi. And I just couldn't stop watching it. It's one of the greatest movie trailers ever. It's in my personal top five favorite movie trailers. And I just watched it and watched it and watched it. And it's one of those trailers where the action is cut to the music. And it's a work of art. So by the time I got around to watching it, I was revved up, pun intended, for this movie. And I really, really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And I do get what you mean. Second time watching, I liked knowing a bit more about what I was walking into. But it's never been quite as effective as it was on the big screen. I just don't think it's a movie that works nearly as well for a home viewing experience. But yeah, it actually won those Oscars, by the way. Six Oscars it won. It was the biggest winning film at the Oscars in 2016. So yeah, it was a big deal. Didn't win Best Picture, though, that year. It went to Spotlight.
And I'm sure you went to probably the same big multimedia screening that I did, Alex. Do you think maybe you did?
I think so. I think on some level, some subconscious level, I knew you were in the room.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just remember that screening feeling like a real event, because I'm not the biggest Mad Max fan. I'll say that now, but it did feel like a big deal. And certainly half an hour in, when it fades to black, I seem to remember there being sort of cheers and claps, which you don't often get in a UK cinema, let alone one filled with bloody journalists. So, yes, as you say,
Were you cheering and clapping?
God, no.
No, me neither. I always wonder who those people are and do they work for the studio? Have they been brought in to cheer and clap? Because I'm like, no self-respecting UK audience member, let alone film journalist, ever cheers and claps in a screening.
They're American. They bring some Americans in and the Americans hoop and holler and on our behalf. So yeah, that was my viewing experience, was seeing it then. But I agree with both of you, actually. I think watching it for the second time this week, I probably enjoyed it more. Although equally, I don't know if I would agree with the statement that it's Furiosa's story, because I don't think she really changes or goes on any kind of personal journey over the course of the film. Unlike Max, who for the third film in a row rediscovers his humanity. Where does he keep leaving it?
He's one of cinema's great forgetful heroes. He discovered there was something I learned in that. I forgot. Fuck it. I'm a loner again.
Well, let's talk about the background to the film because there is quite a lot to get through. I'm just going to cite my references. There is a very good article in the New York Times from May 2020 by Kyle Buchanan, which tells the full story. So 5 years after it was released, he went back to talk to 20 people involved, and he talks to some, you know, really essential people. He talks to George Miller for a start, and the cast and the production designer about what making it was like. So if anybody wants to read that, you should. But I will whip through some of the background to this film. So after doing The Road Warrior and then Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome, not with dogs.
Thunderdome.
Yes. Sorry, did I say the? Oh, God, fuck's sake, sorry. What an unprofessional. Don't correct me for things like that. It's irritating.
I just feel it, seeing as you're citing an article, people are going to think that Kyle Buchanan wrote Beyond the
Thunderdome. Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah. Kyle Buchanan would never do that. I might do that. Beyond Thunderdome.
you sound ready to get in a Thunderdome right now with me.
I'm not in the mood for no.
You sound like Alex right now. Hasn't got a point in the quiz that he thought he should have.
And then he tried to turn Twitter on me. Listeners, get in touch. Let us know. Don't do that. Obviously.
Mob rule.
Right. So anyway, he thought he would leave it alone until he thought, what if there was a Mad Max movie that was one long chase and the MacGuffin was human? And thus the idea for Fury Road was born. But this is back in 2003. So Mel Gibson was going to play Max. They were going to shoot in Namibia, and they went for it. They took the vehicles there. They were building the set pieces. They were going to go for it. Then they got a call from the studio saying, you're not doing it, and stop spending the money. So George Miller decides to do a departure of theme, Happy Feet instead. And so does his film about penguins, which is a massive smash. And so you get to 2006 and he's got enough capital and enough momentum to go back to Fury Road. But by this time, Mel Gibson has been arrested for a DUI and made anti-Semitic and sexist remarks. And so he is not going to be in your film anymore. They did say, George Miller did say, you know, he was probably too old by that point for the action that George Miller wanted, but also he wasn't in a position to be hired because of the comments that he'd made. Jeremy Renner apparently read for it. I didn't know if you knew that, because they hadn't gone to Tom Hardy yet. But then when George met Tom Hardy, he said of him, there's an edgy charm, the charisma of animals, which is something he recognised in Mel Gibson as well. So he thought he'd found a suitable match for Mel Gibson. Mm. So then we've got a 2010 shoot in Australia this time, in Broken Hill, which is where they were before. But just unbelievably, it rained and rained and rained and rained. The sort of rain, quote, that happens once in a century. So what was desert turned into beautiful flowers.
It's the green place. It became the green place.
Mabula.
So unbelievably, they couldn't do it because, you know, you need a desert. So George Miller said, let's wait a year, see if it all dries up. And then it didn't. And so he said, let's go back to Namibia where it never rains. So fair enough. What are we up to now? 2012, we're in the Namibian desert. We've got a script by George Miller and Brendan McCarthy and Nico Lathouris, and we've got our cast. And so we're off. Just a few surprising things that I read in this article, which I would never have known, is that Eve Ensler, who is very well known for writing the vagina monologues, helped flesh out the characters of Immortan Joe's wives. Did you know that?
No.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I only learnt it from the research on this week's show. But yeah, it is. George Miller specifically brought her on to be a consultant on the scenes involving Morton Joe's wives. And I think the film in general.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Eve Ensler was working with Congolese survivors of gender-based violence at the time. So it wasn't like, oh, you did the vagina monologue, so you should do this. There's a bridge for her. But I do think that's, I think that's a really nice touch, because to try and bring a bit of lived experience to those roles. And it's not like they don't have much dialogue, but it's just to help the actors find that space. I think that's a really cool thing to do. It was a very difficult shoot. Zoe Kravitz said, by the end, we wanted to go home so badly. You really do start to lose your mind a little bit. Charlize Theron said, I was incredibly scared because I'd never done anything like it. And so it had one more sort of hiccup before it was in the bag, as it were, because Warner Brothers tried to shut it down again. So apparently they were told the camera's going to stop on December the 8th, no matter what you've got, and that's the end of it. But they hadn't shot the scenes in the Citadel, so they hadn't shot the bookends of the film. They tried to make it work in post without those scenes, but were really struggling. Then they were allowed to finish the film. They reassembled the team, and they gave George Miller an extra month of shooting. And then we get the film that you know. It made $374 million. I've got was nominated for 10 Oscars. But did you say, oh no, it won six. Sorry. Nominated for 10 and won six. So it really paid off. But what a crazy long journey from, when was Beyond Thunderdome? 1985, is that right? Just unbelievable. Just the tenacity, and also the fact that the shoot does sound really, really difficult, because for a lot of it, your main characters are stuck in a truck very close to each other as well. It was hot. It was cold. I think someone got hypothermia. They were all covered in dust. It just sounds like an absolute nightmare. And to come out of that with anything, let alone to come out with it with something good, is amazing.
I remember interviewing Tom Hardy in around 2011 for Sky, for not this movie, obviously, because it was much before then. But I did ask him about it because he'd just flown back. So he had jet lag anyway for this interview. And in classic Tom Hardy style, so he sort of had he was resting his head on his hand and he had his elbow on the arm of the chair. And he did look bored. But like the way he does, he goes, I just want to say, in the middle of the interview, he's like, I want to say on camera, Alex, this is a great interview. I'm really enjoying it. I'm just really jet lagged. I just got back from the Mad Max set. And I was like, oh, that's nice of you to say. How was it? And he just had this glazed look in his eyes. He's like, yeah, all right. I'm like, cool. So yeah, I think he had quite a hard time on this movie. I think he found the whole process quite frustrating. I think partly it was because the actors were given storyboards rather than a shooting script every day for what they were going to be filming, which was George Miller's approach. As a writer, Victoria, how do you feel about that? Actors being given images of what each scene would be.
It blows my mind. If it was anything less than perfection, the film, I'd be like, well, I told you needed a script. But turns out you don't. If you know what you're doing. I mean, I think the actors did really struggle, because it's those micro moments of movement and action that tell the entire story. Like, you have no dialogue to prove your point, make a bridge between scenes, none of that. It is it's an incredible achievement,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, because Road Warrior had 1,200 cuts and this film had 2,700 cuts in it. And Miller definitely said at the time that he could see how frustrated Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron were getting with him, with the film and with each other. And because they largely shot it in order, he said that the first time they meet each other, they in the film, they really weren't getting along with each other, and so that's kind of real. And he said the first time they're even fighting with each other, you could feel there was something there. And then the first time they sort of start sort of liking the other person, he said that was kind of happening on set at the same time as it was happening in the film. So he really put them through the ringer, and it was clearly not an enjoyable experience for either of them. But I think I seem to remember something about them saying in Cannes when they were doing the press conferences, they almost apologised to George Miller.
It was Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy's the one who did it. He says, a journalist basically says, what's your reaction to seeing the finished film? You've just watched it with us. And he's like, it's amazing, and I wish I'd been able to understand George's what he was trying to do at the time on set, because I remember being really frustrated because I didn't know what he wanted me to do at any particular time on the set, which you can imagine being fairly frustrating for an actor. And he sort of goes on to sort of say, you know, what George was having to manage in terms of the spectacle and so many different elements going on, that he sort of apologizes and goes, seeing it now, I mean, it's brilliant. So yeah, he does actually publicly apologize at a press conference, which is kind of rare.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the actresses who play the wives, some of them are more established now, but at the time they weren't established. And so I can't remember if it was Zoe Kravitz or Riley Keough, but said like, we didn't feel that we could ring our agent at the end of the day and be like, is this normal? Like for this level of stress and level of tension. And also I have hypothermia. So I would quite like to come home.
I just lost a toe. Is that normal?
Yes.
Rosie Huntington Whiteley's on fire, as I'm calling you. Is that cool?
She never acted again, did she?
She didn't, no. But then she's a... I mean, she probably was like, it's much easier to be a Victoria's Secret model than freeze my ass up in the desert.
As we all know.
Yeah, I mean, and also, I think being a Victoria's Secret model probably is quite hard, but
haven't we already had this conversation on the pod about whether fucking modelling is hard or not? I don't remember it going well for anyone last time. Maybe we should skip over whether modelling is a difficult job or not.
I just don't want to be the person that makes an assumption about a world I know nothing about and be like, oh, that looks like a piece of piss. Because what do I know? Presumably, they are at the very least a bit peckish.
again, I think we should just move on. Even when we try and go, let's discuss modeling and it's and the actual challenges that being a model involves, it doesn't come out well. Let's crack on.
It doesn't sound very sincere. Okay, fine. Right, so let's just establish the world. We've got another voiceover, Tom Hardy growling at us that my world is fire and blood. I was like, same, Tom Hardy. Same.
Oh, not going out for a drink with you. Fuck it. You just sat down. I've literally just put a pint in front of you. My world is fire and blood. Excellent. Have you watched any box sets?
There's been oil wars. There's been water wars. Our bones are poisoned. Max lives in a literal and metaphorical wasteland because the world around him is blasted and he's haunted by visions from his past and these ghosts of the people that he's lost and left behind. And I do get it. And it does need a voiceover because he doesn't talk to anybody. But you know how I feel about voiceover. And I still feel like it with this, like I know there's no other way around it, but it is a shame that it's a voiceover, sorry to say. But the point of the opening sequence is to establish the energy that this film is capable of. So Max is on the run from the war boys and the thing is absolutely nuts. So the speeding of the frame, the slowing down, the pure energy of it, and it just leaves you thinking, can this film keep this up for 2 hours? When you're not sure because you've never seen it before, that is a thrill. Like, am I really in for this for 2 hours?
But it's just thrilling. And this film keeps going for 2 hours. And do I want it to keep it going for 2 hours?
Yeah, for sure. But then second time around, it's like, I know that it can. And that is also a brilliant treat because I know I'm not going to be disappointed by a lag in the action.
Do you know who the little girl is that he keeps having visions of throughout this film?
Isn't it his daughter?
No, he never had a daughter. He had a son in the first movie who dies. No, I wanted to know because it's always bothered me. I couldn't work out whether it was a continuation of something that had happened in the previous movies where it was one of the Lost Boys in Beyond Thunderdome or like you say, his child. It's I don't know whether you're going to love or hate this, but the answer is found in the Mad Max video game. Which was set just before this film and tells the story of a Morton Joe's son, Scrotus. That's right. His name is Scrotus. And Max is fighting with Scrotus. He becomes involved in trying to topple him. He also comes across a young mother and a child, Hope, and her daughter, Glory. And Scrotus kills both of them before Max can save them. And then Max kills Scrotus. So their visions of the mum and daughter he failed to save in the video game. And also the end of the video game is him being chased by the war boys belonging to Scrotus, which is how Fury Road starts. So that is an explanation from a video game.
Oh, that's good.
It's part of the official Mad Max canon. So it is genuinely attached to this movie and the story here.
Oh, that's, I like that. I don't hate that one bit. So then we meet Immortan Joe, who is bloated and his skin is like suppurating, and he's wearing a chest plate so that the huddled masses underneath him will see him as strong and healthy. And he rules with an iron fist. What?
And yeah, no, you're right. Would you not, if you had, I actually think it's a very clever move. If you had sores all over your body, a perspex bodice is exactly what I'd wear, because I genuinely think any material, it's going to rub. You run the risk of tearing the boils, and, you know, flaky skin would stick to them because your skin is wet. And so perspex, absolutely right. I think it's a very smart move.
No, I wouldn't. I'd wear cotton. I'd wear a light cotton.
You'd rip those sores, V. You'd rip those sores.
I love the side characters all the way through this film, and particularly in that scene. I like the bloke whose job it is to simply blow talcum powder on him.
Yeah.
And then we also very quickly meet Charlize Theron as Imperator Furiosa. Shall we talk about her for 2 minutes?
Sure.
2 minutes. Is that okay? Yeah.
No, we can talk about it for more minutes if you like. How do you feel? Right. A, do you think it's her film? B, what do you think of her as a hero? And C, just general thoughts. Wow. I think it's her film. I think she's an amazing hero. I love the fact that her disability, her missing arm, never gets a mention. I love the fact that she's got a shaven head. So she was talking to the costume designer, Charlize Theron, because originally her character had quite long hair. And when they were working out the character and the things she's been through and the life she leads prior to getting in that war rig and making an escape, her hair was completely impractical. So it was like, why don't we just shave it off? But I love that because it goes against the look at the wives with their beautiful hair. Like, it goes against the idea of what makes a woman have power.
I think she wanted to shave her head and she wasn't sure how it would look. And so she said, yeah, they've asked me to shave it for this movie. And then when people sort of go, it really doesn't suit, she go, yeah, I know, but I had to do it for the movie, but I know it doesn't look good. But you want to try it out once. I'd love to shave my head if someone went, and when people go, what the fuck have you done? Go, it's for a movie. I didn't want to do it.
Well, we'll do it for the podcast, Alex. You can say it's for the podcast. I'll shave your head.
That made me feel weird. It felt like Ghost. It felt like the pottery scene in Ghost, but with you behind me and clippers. I don't like it.
With Victoria singing Unchained Melody.
Absolutely fine to do that. Happy to do that.
I like what we don't find out about her. You know, she's obviously got the tattoo, the stamp on her back of her head. So was she one of the brides previously? We don't know her background. We know she's after redemption, but we never find out what she wants redemption for. And also, I just love the way this film starts as well in what feels like the second act. I think any other film, act one, would have been Furiosa escaping with the brides.
Yeah.
And I'm sure potentially, you know, he started writing this in the 90s. I'm sure he probably wrote that. And then I feel like George Miller just pairs and pairs and pairs his scripts down and his dialogue down until there's bugger all there. And it's just, a visual storytelling. And yeah, I just think it's, I do like the way the title card comes up and then we're in act two.
Yeah, me too. We're just no messing around.
Yeah, and you were right. I agree with you, Victoria, about what you said at the start. Watching it this time, I do think the first time I saw it, I was like, why is Max not doing more? Why is this not about Max? It's called Mad Max. Where's Max? And I was a bit, I didn't have a problem with it, but it wasn't what I expected. Walking into it this time, and knowing what a central part she is to the story and how much is devoted to her story and her taking the brides and her being proactive in helping them escape, I enjoyed that more.
I 100% agree. And I don't think it's our fault. It's the film's fault. It's the title's fault. It's the trailers and the press stuff they do. They tell you this. And another film that did this was Inglourious Basterds, where the first time you watch that and it's suddenly a film about this French woman rather than the Dirty Dozen, as it were, it throws you off a little bit because that's not the movie you've been sold. And so it's not the filmmaker's fault because that's the film they wanted to make. But obviously a title that says Mad Max or Inglourious Basterds, you think it's going to be their story. So that's, I 100% agree. I think that's why the second time you're ready and waiting for it. The one thing I would ask about Furiosa though, and the Brides is, She escapes with these women, but what about the pregnant women producing milk? Why don't they get saved?
Oh God, that made me feel so unsettled.
They've been fast on their feet in terms of running away, but I just feel like it's a bit harsh that they get left behind.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's the pretty women that get saved. Yes. I get that.
The models, as it were.
They are literally models. Yeah, I know what you mean. And also her relationship with the wives is like, she wants to say, why is she risking herself to have this extra cargo that Immortan Joe is definitely going to come for? Whereas she might be able to get away just her if she didn't have the wives in the truck, maybe.
I feel like she was one of those wives, and that's why, because she knows what they're going through, that's why she wants to rescue them.
Yeah. Yes. So later,
we did mention, I know you're probably going to say it anyway, but it's quite funny that Toe Cutter, the actor who played Toe Cutter, is the same actor who plays Immortan Joe, the villain from movie number one, is the villain in movie number four.
Yeah, just slap a mask on him, no one will notice.
That's true. So yeah, we're off basically. Furiosa is taking the wives to freedom. Max is along for the drive, but he is a blood bag, which I can't, it makes me feel so, it's a really good mix of emotions or feelings because I'm very squeamish about drips and lines into, just I can't cope with it. But it also makes me feel, it's really harrowing, the idea that a human being is just a bag of blood and can be strapped to the front of a car. I think it's a really good, it's a really good spectacle, but it just makes me feel so many different things at once.
It's a great spectacle, isn't it? When Nux's mate says, "If you can't stand, you can't do war." I think that's a really good line, and I also think it's something that we should implement on the show because I think. It was over a year ago now, so we're going back in time, but there was one episode, not mentioning any names, where someone was a little bit merry before the show and arguably shouldn't have been on that episode.
The way you were saying it, you're making it sound like it wasn't you.
I remember it differently. I don't know what you're talking about. Maybe that's another occasion. But nevertheless, I think in future, should any of that happen to any one of us, I think the other people should turn to them and go, if you can't stand, you can't do pod. And that is the end of it.
Would you like to direct people? Would you like to direct people to that episode where, as the episode goes on,
I don't think that's a good idea. I think we should crack on. Let's get on. We've got a lot to get through.
Did you have a hangover the next day, Alex? Did you have a hangover?
Hangover. I had a wedding to go to.
Enough said.
Those bridesmaids did not look very happy.
Moving on. Mad Max.
Moving on. So we've got the first of a number of chases. The war boys are in pursuit. And what's amazing about this chase is that, so Nux, I know it's not Nux's friend, but the person that Nux has had a little argument with about, if you can't stand, you can't do war. He uses himself as a human Molotov cocktail during this chase. And that's actually the calmest moment of the whole thing, which is bonkers. When I first saw this, I thought he was spraying accelerant onto his mouth. But is it just chrome coloured spray paint to signal that he's ready for Valhalla? It's not an actual accelerant.
It's a good question. I think it's partly because it looks cool. But I did wonder if he was getting high in the solvent from a spray can at the same time.
George Miller said they chrome their teeth because chrome is such a rare thing. So that was the only quote I could find from him, because I couldn't figure out if it was getting them high in preparation for death, or apparently that was cake spray though. So that's actually quite nice.
Oh, that's nice. It's probably quite sugary.
It's quite good at the start as well. I think one of the things about this film is the fact that it does not feel the need to spoon feed you anything or over elaborate on exposition. And I think that's really great. Like, it demands that you just sort of pay attention and accept this world. Like, where they go, there's Bullet Farm, and Gas Town. And they're just introduced. And it's like gas from Gas Town, bullets from Bullet Farm, and we're off. And there's no sort of explanation as to how that works, what the governing system is of how that relates to Immortan Joe's world, any of that. It's just like, they're two things.
He said that he was really interested in doing this film to make a film for audiences now rather than 30 years ago, because he talked about the fact that we can process information much quicker today. We're speed reading films. And so he's shooting accordingly. But also, I think we're supposed to see some of our own world in some of these details. So the War Boys, he said when he wrote them initially, that was in the 1990s, and they were kamikazes to him. And now, post 9/11, he sees them as suicide bombers, you know, willing to sacrifice themselves for the cause. And so, you know, all this stuff, you know, the trafficking is the brides, and it's a comment on climate change with the way that the green place has disappeared. So, and fascism with Immortan Joe. So all this stuff, we should be able to see our world in this heightened reality on screen.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you can, definitely.
Yeah, I just think as well as Gastown and Bullet Farm, they needed a makeup mall as well. I think that would have been nice if they'd popped along for some makeup at some point. But you're right. I think the one thing I didn't understand, which sort of ties into this this whole, like, here's just some information, deal with it. There's no explanation. When the brides talk about Nicholas Hoult and they go, he's just a kid at the end of his half-life. I couldn't work out what that meant.
I think it's because people don't, because Nicholas Holt's definitely got cancer. You know, he's got the lumps on him, the Larry and Barry lumps, and he's got night fevers. So he's got cancer and he's going to die. So I think your life expectancy is so short now that you talk about it as a half-life, and then you'll have the other half of your life in Valhalla.
Yeah, and it ties back to Thunderdome. So when Max is arriving at Bartertown, he's offered some water, but he won't drink it because there's fallout in the water, which has resulted in all these mutations. So that's where the cancers come from, which is the water, which is why Immortan Joe can enslave everyone because of the water. And so they've got half lives, the War Boys. But the if you look when Max is deemed a universal donor, it says he's a full life. So that's why he's
got quality, that's interesting.
Yeah, quality blood, but it's written on there. So again, all the details are there, but it just goes past so quickly that I don't think anyone could speed read fast enough to pick it all up first time.
Yeah.
You just mentioned Beyond Thunderdome there, and just before he did Beyond Thunderdome, Mel Gibson actually auditioned for Amadeus. You know the movie Amadeus? He auditioned for the main role of Mozart Amadeus, Mel Gibson did.
Oh, here also, we go. I know who played that character on stage, Alex. Do you?
Well, I know who played it on stage. I also know who auditioned alongside Mel Gibson to play in the film. I didn't get it either. It was Tim Curry. And that completes this week's obligatory Tim Curry reference. Carry on.
Okay. shall we just have a little chat? Oh, actually, let's have a break first. Let's have a break. Okay, we've had a break. She's a professional broadcaster.
You've got to give our lovely producer Blondine enough time to put the break in.
Yeah, there's a break. Break's done. We've finished the break. Start a break. Here we go. Break. Break over.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This week at Sukarnov.
On Wrestle Me This Week, we talked about the worst way to accept a Hall of Fame award.
They were just chanting, you suck it.
You suck, and then he pours milk over
his head.
What is this?
Pouring milk over yourself is absolutely something that if you did it once in any scenario, people would never forget it. We were just having Christmas dinner and he just poured 2 litres of milk over himself.
Or if you're more in the mood for some awkward anecdotes, Alex shared his experience with the cast of Event Horizon on this week's Clash of the Titles.
We meet Smitty, played by Sean Pertwee, a man who I bumped into in a bar having never interviewed and literally chewed his ear off, trapped him in a corner of a booth where he couldn't actually stand up and get away from me and talk to him incessantly about this film. Later on in the night, his wife said to me, Sean's outside if you want to carry on talking to him about Event Horizon.
All that and more at Sukarnov.
Back from our break, let's talk about Nooks for a second, because he has quite a heartbreaking character journey. He has quite a lot of dialogue in comparison to the other characters, and really in comparison even to the characters in Mad Max 2. So it's interesting that you were talking about suicide bombers and kamikazes, this sort of very ideologically driven group of people, because Nicholas Hoult's character sees the lie and sees through, I mean, quite quickly, to be fair, but sees through the veneer of what he's been sold and does a full 360 and is sort of with the goodies towards the end. I think it creates a few issues for the Act 3 resolution, but it's still kind of fine because Nicholas Hoult is a revelation as that character, and I bought it completely.
Yeah, I completely forgot that he has that turnaround in this film of 5 years later. I completely forgot, and I ended up watching it again after I watched it this time because I thought it was so beautifully played by him. It's something that George Miller's really interested in, as Alex calls them, the Lost Boys in Thunderdome, and then you've got the War Boys here, about people who are, he calls them, culturally impoverished, with no books and no internet, no theatre, no radio, no music. All they have is the detritus of the past. And they refashion it into, so a steering wheel becomes a religious artifact, and they do the sign of the VA, and the engine they sacrifice their bodies on becomes sort of more than that. And so it's interesting seeing how sort of a demagogue could take advantage of that, and Morton Joe can turn himself into a tyrant by brainwashing these ill-educated lads.
And yeah. also, I guess what they do is they turn their acts of violence into a performance in the film, which then becomes their equivalent in the absence of TV or theatre or anything. It becomes the stories they tell. For example, when they do something incredible or they're about to do something incredible, they shout, "Witness this," as in make sure you see this, because then this will become a story. Like when the guy jumps off with the two exploding spears, he says, "Witness this beforehand," so it becomes a fable.
Yeah, that's amazing, because it's like you know, even if there's no theatre, TV, whatever, obviously you'd always have stories, but Immortan Joe has captured their narrative framing devices so that the only stories they can tell fit with furthering his vision.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And you could say that's the overarching theme of all these movies. It's not about the same bloke bloody losing and finding his humanity over and over again, but it's the creation of myth and legend. And even if the first film doesn't have it as much, I mean, literally from the opening shots of Mad Max, you're hearing about him and hearing people talk about him before you see him. You just get glimpses of his you know, his leather boots and his gun and stuff. And so right from the opening scenes of the first film, he was... this is what George Miller was examining, is how we create myth and legend in culture.
Mm. And he's done it. Each film is basically, you know, it's a story around a campfire. It's kind of like retelling each movie as in what this guy did. Yeah.
Yeah. So back to the plot, after this just unbelievable sandstorm that the convoy goes through, which is at once it's monochrome with these flashes of electricity, and then it's pulsing and it's red and pink and it looks like the inside of a body.
So here's a question. Why the hell did George Miller do that black and white or black and chrome version of this? You know, he released Fury Road without any colour in it, when you spent all this time on the reds and the orange and the yellows of scenes like this. It doesn't make any sense to me why he'd bother doing that.
Because he actually wanted to shoot. Originally, he wanted Fury Road to be shot in black and white. He wanted to shoot the whole thing in black and white. He didn't want to make a colour version. And the studio wouldn't let him because they said it would put off blockbuster audiences, probably correctly. And so he then went the other way entirely and demanded that every scene in the film had to be littered with as much colour and be as bright as possible.
But did he say why he wanted to shoot it in black and white? Because this is what I don't understand. When Bong Joon-ho did Parasite, he did the black and white version of that. He didn't lie or pretend anything other than the truth. He just said, "I wondered what it would look like in black and white." The film wasn't supposed to be in black and white at any point. But I don't understand what the logic was here.
I think it's because it makes things look cool. Right. That is it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever had a photograph of yourself taken in black and white, but you will look better than you do in colour.
I 100% agree, but I think this film would look less cool. I think it does look less cool in black and white. But
yeah, I agree with you, Chris. There's a scene early on when they first launch the flares as they're gaining on the war rig, Immortan Joe and his gang, and the flares. I get goosebumps when those flares explode in the sky, because it's so beautiful. I genuinely, my notes for this film have "it's so beautiful" written over and over and over again. At one point, I felt a little bit like Jodie Foster in Contact, going, no words.
"I'm ready to go."
okay to go.
Where are we up to? Okay, so Max is recruited by Furiosa into sort of joining their mission, which is to get to the green place. And after an amazing chase, we lose one of the pregnant wife, Ang Harriet, and she's presumed dead. And this is to show, it's to do a lot of things, but it shows that Max is kind of warming up a bit, because Ang Harriet nearly dies and she's on the side of the rig and he sort of looks at her like, "I hope you're all right." And then just as he's done that look, she just gets swept under the wheels of the oncoming vehicle, and the classic sort of, "We're going to leave her behind because we've got a bigger mission." And he has no problem with that.
When the brides are first introduced is quite a good scene. When Max sort of opens his eyes and then he rounds the corner of the war rig and they're just spraying each other with the hose. Now, I know you find movies where women have fun by spraying each other an issue, Victoria. I think in this instance, it's different because they are cleaning each other off That sounded weird.
Stop!
You're making me horny, Alex.
Oh my god!
How hard are they cutting anyway, each other off?
Okay. Now, my point is a valid one, though, because it does make you realise that they have led, whether they want to escape or not. Well, they do want to escape, but they've led quite a sheltered life because of how wasteful they're being of the water. They've got no idea what it's like out on the wasteland. Mm. And I also do like the chastity belt with teeth, even if it reminds me a lot of Robin Hood Men in Tights.
It's five wives here as well, but originally it was seven, and that's because George Miller was going back to these old Aboriginal legends and myths that traditionally involved seven wives, but he had to narrow it down to five because he couldn't fit that many in the cabin of the rig. And when he was asked if this was ever just going to be a Max story and how Furiosa came into it, and he said it was always a woman rescuing the wives, because if it had been Max, it became a story about one man stealing another man's wives, which is a very different tale.
Yeah, I'm totally on board. Like the fact that it's a woman rescuing women, you're allowed to have, you know, for me, you can have vulnerable women and strong women and that's fine. But if you've got vulnerable women being rescued by a strong man, it's just a very different story. And it's not that I don't enjoy that story, but I'd like to see something a bit different, which is a very strong woman helping out her peers kind of thing. So the baby is cut out of Angharad, and another month and it would have been a nearly viable human, but the baby doesn't make it and neither does she.
Nope, she don't make it. There's a good bit where Immortan Joe gets Nicholas Hoult to try and help him take back the rig, and like Nicholas Hoult is overwhelmed at the fact that Immortan Joe is talking to him and is giving him this mission, and then he totally fucks it up. He gets his chain caught on something and falls off the side. And Immortan Joe uses a burn that is something I really feel should be brought into the real world, and everyone should say it. When someone does something less than impressive, you should do what Immortan Joe does, which is just go, mediocre.
Yeah, I like that.
Like your performance in the quiz.
Exactly. It's not like that was rubbish. It's just like mediocre. Brilliant.
But it's the look on it, such as his face is. He's like, if you want something fucking done, you've got to do it yourself. It is brilliant. The rig is stuck in the mud. So this is where, because Immortan Joe sort of burning Nux in that way helps Nux on this journey to sort of see him through his leader. And he redeems himself at this point by helping the rig, which is stuck in the mud, helping it like lash it around a chain around a tree. It's not working. And this is the bit I like the most in this scene, is then Charlize Theron sort of gets down by the wheel and gives it a push. And because she's such a badass, you're like, that might make the difference, actually. Like, it's this massive rig, it's round a tree, but she's like, oh, just give it a push, and then we're off. So we are on our way. Well, no, doesn't she find her old clan kind of by accident, or does she know where she's going? Because at this point, we see a naked woman in a kind of hanging basket, quickly identified as bait, but she is part of the, say it without laughing, the Vuvolini, which is Furiosa's old clan from which she was kidnapped, and she's reunited with them. And it is really affecting when she talks about the length of time she's been away for. I wasn't sure if this is how they mark time in this imaginary world, but she knows the exact number of days, which means that she's never been fully assimilated into Immortan Joe's cult because she's been counting the time so specifically, and she lost her mum on the third day, and that's very sad.
It's weird, isn't it? Because they're about the same age, Tom Hardy and Furiosa, and so clearly their characters are approximately the same age, which means I don't understand how the timeline matches up. I know there's not really meant to be much continuity between the films, but she was born into this sort of clan, the Vuvolini, and that feels like a wasteland. That feels like a post-apocalypse clan. Mm. And yet Max, at this point, like, he hadn't even sort of joined the MP, what were they called?
Alex, there is no continuity. George Miller has no interest in continuity, so there's no point in even thinking about it. He's just losing my mind. It says it's a, you know, what he's trying to do is talk about human behavior repeating over time, and he's got this same character repeating over time, and he actually compares it to James Bond in the way that it sounds like he'd be quite happy to let other people tell Mad Max stories when he's had enough.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm not going to try and work out the chronology then.
Don't bother.
So anyway, the green place is this blasted wasteland. Furious has this howl of pain in the desert, and all Max can do is look on because this isn't his story. But the film is named after him, so he's going to come up with the plan, which is we're going to turn around and we're going to go back the way we came, because if there's only salt in front of us and the green place is this wasteland behind us, we're going to go back to the Citadel, which is now undefended. And we're going to take it. And I think someone at some point says it'll be quite easy, which is good.
Do you think when she says we're going to drive across the salt plains in that direction, and he goes, you can drive hundreds of miles, 100 days in that direction, you won't find anything. Is that because that was the sea, basically? They're driving on the seabed. Do you think that?
Oh, wow. I never thought that. I did. It works. I was a bit like, well, why? How do you know? Because have you done it? But if you've done it, I buy that you've done it because you're this unknowable character and you could have been wandering around all over the place.
It's a very clever moment, though, earlier on where she is directing the war rig into the mountain canyon and he goes, don't go that way. So he clearly knows the landscape and he knows where he is at that point and tells them to avoid the mountain pass because he knows there's a gang on motorbikes.
Yeah, that's true.
So you are led to believe he is a very worldly man.
Yeah. And everyone's really excited about the plan. The brides are excited about it. The older ladies, the Vulvalini. How am I saying that? All I've written is vulva, which is not right, is it?
Vuvuzela is how you say it.
I love the Vuvuzela. Oh, that takes me back.
No one loved the Vuvuzela.
I honestly did. I got really into it. I really did. I missed it when it was over with. I did. Just that. Such an annoying noise. But very evocative. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so we are on our way back. We've got another incredible chase sequence. It's slightly repetitive, but it is livened up this time because we've got older ladies getting stuck in and the polecats, which have been mentioned earlier in the film and hinted at in Mad Max 2, but now they're finally used to full effect. So Max at one point, he just keeps getting like plucked off vehicles and thrown all over the place. And it is quite hard to watch because it's quite dazzling and there's so much going on, but obviously it is incredible.
No words. There's a bit where Tom Hardy's head, you know, you always sort of go, I wonder how they did that. And did they do it for real? And is that the actor? Is that a stuntman? That looks very real. There's a bit where Tom Hardy's suspended, like, from the war rig, and his head is very close to the ground, and they're traveling along, and that's really him. He's there. Yeah, he's there. He's got wires attaching him to the actual war rig to make sure he doesn't hit the ground. Tom Hardy's son came to set and voiced some concerns about how thin the wires were that were keeping his dad's head from touching the ground. And he asked George Miller what might happen if the wires snapped. And George Miller said, I suppose he'll go under the wheels.
Oh my God.
He didn't say that. He's a nice man.
I imagine he was joking, but he did say it.
Wow.
Oh, okay. I mean, Tom Hardy looks terrified when his head is nearly being like cheese grated over the desert floor. I just assumed that was not him and it wasn't happening for real. But I think I was just protecting myself because it's too scary, really, otherwise. Mm. So anyway, best bit of this, obviously, is Furiosa is on the side of Immortan Joe's cab and she rips his face off to death.
It still makes me flinch. What a great death. It's so awful.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And when she says...
It's also using something, I guess, he's sort of privileged. Like, if he wasn't Immortan Joe, he would be dead because of whatever issue he has with his lungs.
Yeah.
But because he's privileged, he's had this thing built to keep him alive, and it's the thing that it's his sign of privilege that is the thing that ultimately undoes him.
Yeah. And also she says, well, she growls it out, but she says, remember me, which is a really interesting thing to throw in at this late stage because she's such a trusted Imperator. You think they may have had a personal relationship, And then we're piecing these things together that maybe she was one of the wives and maybe she was a sex slave and maybe she'd forced pregnancies and all of this. But she assumes he wouldn't even remember her, even if that was the case. And that is super dark.
Mm.
Yeah. So still, I mean, he's name-checked her earlier on in the film, so he clearly does know exactly who she is. So
yeah.
Her saying, remember me, it's like, well, yeah, I remember when I said, Imperator Furiosa is driving the warring.
That's true, actually.
Obviously, I know who you are. You're Imperator Furiosa.
Yeah, I really just did, yeah.
Hands off my mask. That hurts. I thought, I don't know whether she was... I sort of read it differently. It doesn't really work how I read it, but I don't think the way you said it works either, because he obviously remembers who she is. But I sort of read it like the idea that wherever he's going, whether it's to hell or Valhalla or whatever, just remember it was me that killed you.
I thought that's what I thought as well.
Okay. Oh, okay. Not like when you say, oh, remember me to your mum and dad. You know when someone's going to say,
remember me? Not like that. It's just more like, remember me.
Yeah, it's more remember me rather than remember me.
Hello!
Hiya!
Furious Furiosa here!
Circa Alexane 2016. Anyway, so Nux dies at this point. With the music and Nux's death, which is a heroic death, it started to feel, and maybe it had always felt like this, but a lot like a war film. Like the music behind his sacrifice.
Well, he is a war boy. He is a war boy, so.
He is a war boy, to be fair to him. Furiosa is in a bad way, so Max acts as a blood bag, which is cool, but also a bit like, is that all you can do kind of thing? Like, that's how you save someone's life. But he then gives her this little morsel, which is he tells her his real name, having been referred to by her as Fool earlier on and seeming a bit reluctant to tell her his name. And I love that as a payoff, and it's fine as a thing. But I was sort of hoping for something a bit juicier than his name, given that I already know his name. And so maybe there was a secret that we could have found out at that same time that would have buttoned it for me.
Yeah.
I'm your brother, perhaps.
Remember me?
Wait, do you mean remember me or remember me? What? Say it, Max. It is Max, right? Max, say it again.
And so we get back to the Citadel. Now, this is my one, like, thing where it's like, I love it, and I love the fact that Furiosa claims the Citadel, but I do think it's a shame that there was no last fight, and that there probably wasn't time and there probably wasn't the money. But they walk into the Citadel, and Immortan and Max throws Immortan Joe's body, or reveals it, sorry, pulls off the sheet and shows everyone the body. So the war boys are inculcated in Immortan Joe culture as exemplified by Nux. But they're not like, oh my God, you've killed him and now we're going to kill you. They're like, yay, he's dead. And that's also fine.
They call them war pups, don't they? They say there's just the pups left. So they're not sort of fully, I guess, fully indoctrinated war boys. They're just young kids who look like war boys in the making.
But then you're saying every single person in that crowd, those emaciated, huddled masses, every single person hates Immortan Joe and is waiting for him to die. And if you've been indoctrinated, I don't think that's how you would feel. I expected there to be one more fight. So you've got a kind of a fake ending when they walk into the Citadel and there is just a battle to be done before she gets to claim it for herself. Mm. But I totally get why there wasn't. I mean, given... The fact that it took however many years to even get this far, there probably wasn't time. And maybe no one thought it was necessary, but...
You know how much I love action. I think another fight at this point would have broken me. I was ready for it to end when it ended. Yeah. I think any more fighting, I'd have been like, oh, for fuck's sake, come on.
I do have one more little fact, which is about a prequel called Furious... It's actually called Furious Furiosa. So, Alex, I think you might need to talk to George Miller about that.
Wonderful name! What a name! That's incredible.
I know, it's really, it just really tells you everything about her, I think.
Furious Furiosa.
Furious Furiosa. So it's in advanced development.
Remember me?
Question mark? Charlize Theron probably isn't going to be in it because George Miller has talked about using the CG de-aging technique and really loving what they've done on The Irishman, but not feeling that it's quite there yet for him. So it won't be her, which is a bit of a shame.
It's Anya Taylor-Joy.
Is it?
She auditioned over Zoom during lockdown and got the part.
No way. Yeah. No way! Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, the Queen's Gambit, if you don't know who that name is. Yeah, she was recently in the Queen's Gambit. Yeah, she's good. I think she's a great choice.
Yeah, good for her. Amazing.
Yeah. Chris Hemsworth is also in it, along with Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who we obviously talked about on that really weird pairing of Waterworld and, and Aquaman.
Oh, the fishmen pairing. Terrific.
Fishmen, yeah. That's it. That's really all I have. Would you like to do the bits? Do you have any more?
No, let's do it.
Chris, what was your best scene?
Oh, God, I don't know. I'm going to say the chase through the caves at the start, because I feel like we know that George Miller can do cars, but it was really lovely to see a foot chase for a change in one of his films. And I kind of would have liked maybe to see it mixed up a little more throughout the film rather than just the car thing, because we've seen the car thing before. So, yeah, I like that just because it was quite refreshing. And also it was just so kinetic and exciting. I love that scene.
And the fight scene that he does between Furiosa and Max by the war rig when they first meet is also a really well done fight scene.
Yep.
Yeah, agreed. What's your best scene, Alex?
It's the very first attack on the war rig by the first gang that they meet before Immortan Joe's caught up with them, who drive the spiky cars and basically look like Tusken Raiders from Star Wars.
The cars that ate Paris as well. Do you know that Peter Weir film with spiky cars in it from one of the early exploitation films? It's obviously an homage to that, the spiky cars, which is very cool.
Yeah, I just think for me, I love it when the polecats turn up later. But it's this first car chase where you first see how amazing and what a spectacle and how goddamn beautiful and the action is going to be, and also seeing like what he's done before in like The Road Warrior and how he's upgraded it for this, it's just incredible. And you like I think it's also before, and I do love this film from start to finish, but action fatigue does set in this movie. By the end I'm a bit like, all right, I'm a bit worn out by all the action, and this is the first time you see the car based action in the film, so it's still really exciting at this point.
Yeah, agreed. My is also the same as Chris's, like almost word for word, the opening scene, the chase through the caves, because it establishes where you you get your footing with what's about to happen, and that sort of that excitement of like, this is what I'm going to be living through for the next 2 hours is makes it amazing. Most valuable whatever, Alex.
I'm going with Tom Hardy, and I genuinely like think he is a phenomenal actor. Like, I think he is genuinely, and I do mean this genuinely, one of the most exciting actors working today, because he does like a thing where he'll take a role that he's given and approach it in such a unique way and portray a character unlike anything that you'd expect from the kind of character that he's playing. And I think like in all his films, like Inception, Lawless, like The Drop, The Revenant, like he just does make strange character choices in how they come across on screen. And I think it's really, really exciting.
Do you think he's a better Max than Mel Gibson?
I think he's the right Max for now, for sure. I think that sounds like a politician's answer.
I think he's
the right Max for now. I don't think you can judge them really, because I think what Mel Gibson is the driving force behind the Mad Max movies he's in, and Tom Hardy isn't in this. I think we're on different sides of the fence, whether it's Furiosa's story or Max's story. I know you think it's Furiosa's story, but I just think he's given less to do here as Max than Mel Gibson was when he was Max. So I don't think they're really entirely comparable.
Also, Alex, it is all right to say that you're scared of him and you don't want him to fall out with you next time you see him. That's fine. He's quite an imposing person, I imagine. That's cool.
Which one?
Yeah, fair enough. I was thinking of Tom Hardy, but let me know if you interview Mel Gibson, because I've got a few comments.
I did interview Mel Gibson, but Daddy's Home too.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Of the two, Tom Hardy, Mel Gibson, Mel Gibson scarier.
Unless you're, I think I've told you this before, unless you're interviewing him on the set of Bronson when he stayed in character.
Yeah. I mean, you see, that's such a Tom Hardy thing to do as well. And like, I think sometimes, like, I think he's quite an imposing presence on a film set in terms of his belief in how he should play a role. And I do think sometimes it doesn't work. I think you watch a film like Legend, and he's fucking brilliant in Legend, but I think the rest of the film suffers because of how big his performance is. And I think it maybe just shows up like a film that can't keep up with his performance sometimes. I find him so exciting to watch.
Yeah, me too. What's yours, Chris?
I mentioned getting the different Brian May to score the previous film. I got a quote from George Miller in 85. He said, "I've never been able to figure out how to fit rock and roll music into a Mad Max film. I can't believe we haven't mentioned him already, but the Doof Warrior is my MVW. He's the man with the guitar on the front of a rig, and he is going for it with fire coming out of his guitar and rock music." And so I'm really pleased that George Miller figured out a way to fit rock and roll music into a Mad Max film. I'm just surprised it was this way.
And it was the guy, I think he's like a visual artist or something, the Australian guy who plays the guitar in it. He was actually controlling the fire that came out of his guitar himself with the whammy bar. So he'd hit the whammy bar and fire would come out of the end of his guitar, which is amazing, except that it would make every time you used a whammy bar after that really disappointing. Like, you just use it for a whammy bar, like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You're like, fucking fire.
I imagine he lives at Burning Man as well. His name's Iota. His name is Iota.
That's awesome. Mine is, to quote the journalist Chris Tilley from episode one, "I'm a big fan of your choices, but someone should say George Miller." So I'm going to say George Miller for just hanging on in there, not fucking up his own vision when you've got like unbelievable amounts of money being thrown at you compared to where you started, but also to hang on in there for all those years and all those setbacks and to stick to your vision and pull it off. And I'm sure a lot of the cast felt that their lives may be in danger at some point because it's just bananas, but he pulled it off. Everyone was safe. It's a job well done.
That is the same as going, it was a great shoot. No one died.
No one died.
That was your day. No one died. Is it any good? Did you not just hear me? No one died.
No one died. And it's finished. So it's finished and no one died. So then the rest.
Congratulations, George. Another fantastic shoot. No one died.
Right, if you could change one thing, Chris, what would you change?
I'm going to contradict what we've all been saying, I think, throughout this episode, but I'd cut out all the bits between the action. And who knows, maybe that's what he will end up doing. He does seem to be, paring down the form of these films. So I think we will maybe just get a 2-hour action sequence before he's done with this.
And you, Alex?
I would like to have seen the character of the Gyro Captain return, as he did in Beyond Thunderdome from The Road Warrior. I think he should be in this, not just because I like the character, and I don't necessarily think Bruce Spence would play him, seeing as obviously Max has been recast in this as well. But I do think he adds a lightness to the proceedings that I do think is missing from this film, just a little bit more humour. And if I could throw my hat in with one actor who should have played him, I'm going with Reese Iffens. I think
it looks exactly like him.
Well, you're wrong.
It's nothing to do with it. It's about his talent.
It's Mackenzie Crook. But that's something I actually had on my list of changes. Because he plays someone who flies in both 2 and 3, and the power of flight is so important in both those films. It's disappeared from this one. Where has that gone in part 4? And that's maybe he'll introduce it in the Furiosa movie. But it was just interesting that we lost that from this one.
Yeah. Which I think adds an element to the action as well. Like, not just like in terms of the story and the world and how there is one flying vehicle, but visually it's great to have something flying alongside a chase sequence. So, yeah, I agree.
My change, and this is dark as you like, but I want to believe that Immortan Joe is the worst of the worst and has complete disregard for most human life, but especially the lives of the women that he's using as baby machines. So when Ang Harrod goes under the wheels of the car, and in the film that we see, he holds her body and he's like, no! I think he should have someone cut the baby out of her at that moment on the side of the road, because she's absolutely useless to him because he thinks she's dead. So why is he keeping her body? Because he wants the baby. And so he shouldn't. I know.
And she, as the knife hits her belly, she opens her eyes and screams and then dies.
Possibly. I mean, yeah,
you wanted it dark. You wanted it dark. That's dark.
Yeah, sorry. I shouldn't shame you for going.
Let's go there.
Down that road.
I'll take it and run with it. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't believe I was thinking that. I was like, that's absolutely what should have happened. So that's it. We're done.
All right. Lovely. That was Fury Road. It went up against Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. Oh, it's going to win. It's time for the verdict.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
Does anyone particularly want to go first? Shall I go first?
Go first, Alex.
Well, thanks for that vote of confidence. Okay. So both are great films, in my opinion. The spectacle of Fury Road makes me weep tears of joy. I love Tom Hardy's take as Max, and I genuinely do think the action is it's art. It's a beauty rarely seen done on screen. Practically. The Road Warrior is a film that blew my mind as a kid, and it's a vision of the future in its production design that's had this massive impact on subsequent movies and video games and everything. So what this came down to for me is that both films have really lean stories, and yet one has a lean story that still packs more of an emotional punch than the other. And that is what I voted on this week. The film that I think, despite the lean storytelling, has huge emotional beats to it. So I am going with Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior.
Oh, wow. I was not expecting that.
Yeah. Yeah, I cried in Mad Max 2, and as well as loving the action. And Mad Max Fury Road, I just sort of sat back and loved the action, but it didn't hit me in my tiny little heart.
So what you're saying is you don't care about pregnant women.
As much as I care about dogs. No, you're absolutely right. I'll stand by that.
Oh, dear. Do you want to go next, Chris?
I'm easy. Go on, you do it, Vicky.
All right, I'll be quick. So I do love how in Mad Max 2, Max stays peripheral to the heart of the emotional beats. He's just helping those people escape. And yet you still care about him and you care about what happens next to them. Whereas in Fury Road, you know, you've got a character that famously doesn't connect with anyone, but he is kind of invested in what happens to the women and everything going on around him. And even when he leaves at the end, you sort of are a little bit surprised, whereas I quite like the coldness of Mad Max 2. And he's like, no, I'm still definitely going to go. But I do love how strong a character Furiosa is in Fury Road. And she's the sort of character that will stay with me. And then you've just told me about Anya Taylor-Joy. And it's like, I'm really excited to see that because I'm really interested to know where she came from. And the thing is, obviously, as an action movie, you can't really fault Fury Road. Like, you just, the way it makes you feel, it's thrilling. And they're both brilliant pieces of cinema in their own way, but I am quite shallow and I'm just going to go with the thing that blew my mind visually. So Fury Road.
One apiece. Christopher Tilly, aka Chris Thrilly. Where are you going?
Well, like I said, I've really enjoyed this week. I've loved celebrating the brilliance of George Miller and his mastery of the form, crafting emotion through action and plot through these tiny details. That economy of storytelling is pure cinema. And I'll say I was impressed by the spectacle of both these movies, even if they do leave me quite cold. The Mad Max films just in general do that. Fury Road is almost too much. It's so exhausting that if I'm in the mood for a Mad Max movie, I think I might sooner put on The Road Warrior. But equally, The Fury Road is George Miller at the height of his powers. He talked about he learned editing, making the first film. He learned where to put the camera from doing the Happy Feet movies, funnily enough. And so using using all the tools at his disposal and everything he's learned along the way, I feel like Fury Road is the ultimate Mad Max movie, so it's going to be that.
Wow! Okay. Again! I feel this keeps happening.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to mention the poll.
Really?
Okay, there is a poll on Twitter.
You mentioned it last week when Event Horizon, when you didn't mention the poll, and I was going to bring it up, but I thought, no, don't stoop to that level.
but now anyway. you feel ready to stoop? Is that what you're saying?
Alex, you're supposed to do the big announcement. Why are you doing this? You spoil it. You spoil it when you lose.
I am thrilled. Mad Max Fury Road is our winner this week. Congratulations. A few weeks ago, we did three Nicolas Cage movies. And on the pod,
congratulations to George Miller. Fury Road has won this week.
and then there was a poll.
What about next week's movies?
At Clashpod, The Rock won, like I said it would. Right, next week's movies. Chris, what was the clue you gave us?
Well, there was a brilliant clue that Vicky, Alex and myself came up with on Twitter, which should have helped you all. But the clue I said was sex and drugs and rock and roll and disco and violence. And so the films we are putting together are, Victoria, you have got Goodfellas.
Yay!
And... wow. Alex, you have got Boogie Nights. And we will talk about the similarities between those two films, of which there are many, you'll be surprised to hear, potentially, next week.
Boogie Nights versus Goodfellas. We start with Goodfellas on Monday. There is your homework for the weekend. Thank you very much for listening. Congratulations to Mad Max Fury Road. Please do follow us on Twitter at ClashPod, on Instagram at ClashPod, and rate and review us, and indeed subscribe to us if you haven't done already, wherever you get your pods. And if you're able to do that, that would be lovely. Take care. Goodfellas on Monday. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.